Vancouver, Canada, where I teach at the Vancouver School of Theology in the areas of New Testament and Early Church. And today it's my joy to talk with you about the developments of hierarchy in the early church after Paul. And we're going to be looking at a series of documents which are attributed to Paul, but for a variety of reasons, which scholars propose probably weren't, for a variety of reasons, probably weren't written by Paul. These documents are New Testament documents, Colossians, the epistle to Colossae, Ephesians, and then the letters which have come to be known generally as the pastoral epistles, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. So we're going to be looking at some of the later writings of the New Testament period. But in order to do that, I want to talk first a little bit about the crisis which the early church faced. Now, oftentimes when we hear that the early church faced a crisis, the first thing that comes to mind is that the crisis was that Jesus didn't return. That is to say that the apostles and so on had hoped for a swift return of Jesus, but that in fact Jesus didn't return, and as we all know, the world continued on. And in the face of a swift return of Jesus, I noted yesterday that Paul counsels them in 1 Corinthians 7:29. He says, "The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as they were not rejoicing. And those who buy as they had no goods, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it, for the form of this world is passing swiftly away." So then, the non-return of Jesus then has been interpreted by scholars as a profound kind of crisis of legitimacy for the early church. A 19th century theologian said that Jesus and Paul had predicted that Jesus would come again, and what came instead was the church. And so today we're going to be taking a look at this church that came and this church that developed. Now, I think that the failure, if you will, of Jesus to return swiftly, as Paul had hoped, while that was certainly a crisis, there was a more profound crisis, I think, which faced the early church. And that crisis is not one which perhaps comes immediately to mind. And I would suggest that perhaps a much more profound and immediate crisis which faced earliest Christian communities was the death of Paul himself. The death of the community founder, the death of the father of those faithful of these communities, the Apostle Paul. And that then his death represented a profound kind of turning point in the life of early churches. And that this then gave birth to a series of institutions which then shaped Christianity and which in many ways has left a legacy for us to inherit. We saw yesterday, or at least those who were at my session yesterday, will remember that Paul was a missionary to the Gentiles. And that as he went about forming communities, he simply adopted the prevailing social institutions available to him and built communities and founded communities along the organizational patterns which were at hand. And central amongst the ones which he adopted were those of the Greco-Roman household. Now, the Greco-Roman household was quite a different phenomenon from the 20th century North American household in that it was a very hierarchical institution, which included typically a husband and a wife, slaves, and then business associates. And there is a real kind of pecking order. And when Paul baptizes households, I was showing yesterday, these social relations are simply adopted by him. They're introduced into the church. And when Paul leaves a community and he goes on his way to found other communities, it is primarily the householders who function as patrons of the church, those householders who invite the church to meet in their homes. It is these people who become the leaders of the community in Paul's absence. I was arguing also yesterday that the tendency to hierarchy gets softened by Paul's emphasis on a swift return of Jesus. So he says, you know, let those who marry act as though they have no wives, let those who buy act as though they have no goods, for this order is passing swiftly away. In other words, this is just an interim kind of ethic. And in other passages, Paul will say, for example, in Galatians 3:28, in Christ there is neither slave nor free, male nor female, Greek nor Jew. So that the reality of existence in Christ, then, the more profound spiritual reality, is that the social distinctions are obliterated, but by virtue or by necessity of the fact that the community needs to survive in the world, Paul nonetheless adopts them and gives them a kind of a passing value, just as time goes on. So that was basically where we left off yesterday. But what happens then when the founder, when the missionary dies? What happens to these communities then? And this is a topic now which I'm going to address today. And I'm going to be looking at a series of writings which the more critical scholarly community has regarded as probably written in the name of Paul, but probably not coming from Paul himself. And these are the documents which I've already listed, and for the latecomers, I'm going to be looking at Colossians, Ephesians, 1 and 2 Timothy, and Titus. It may be something of a shock to some of you to hear somebody standing up here saying that Paul probably didn't write documents in the New Testament which are attributed to him. And it would take me about 3 hours to go through all the argumentation and so on to give a reasonable explanation of why it is that scholars think that these documents weren't in fact written by Paul. By saying that they weren't written by Paul, I'm not at all trying to suggest that they're not inspired, nor am I trying to suggest that they shouldn't be authoritative for the church. I'm rather asking us to step back into the first century for a moment and to realize that it was a commonplace in the early Roman period to write a document and to attribute it to a great hero of the past. And so it would have been a completely natural thing then for a first century person who was a disciple of Paul to pen a document and then write it as though Paul were writing it. That for them was a sign of honoring this great founder and their parent in the faith. So for what us seems to be fraud, right, to them was actually something quite different. So if you will, I'm just asking you to go with me and to assume with me that these documents don't come from the hand of Paul, but that they represent writings from a later period. And I would be most happy to engage those who have questions about that after our session. So I don't want to shut down conversation, but just in the interest of time to kind of move along. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Is that okay? Okay. So I'm going to be taking a look then first at Colossians and Ephesians to kind of set a kind of a tenor for the evening. And to do that, I want us to spend some time in just some smaller groups for about 5 minutes, and I want us to take a look at some passages, and I want us to address three different questions. Now, the passages are, firstly, and your group may just pick one of them, it won't be necessary to look at both of them, but one of the passages is Colossians 3:18-4:1. The second passage is Ephesians 5:21-6:9. So maybe if you could just gather together, perhaps in groups of five, and there's going to be a little bit of hubbub here. So the ideal here is to immerse ourselves a little bit in the text and address each of these questions. And there are Bibles off on the side. So the first thing I wanted you to do is to say, what effect did this advice have on communities? And the second one is, how does the writer value secular institutions? And then the third one is to compare the passage with 1 Corinthians 7:29, and what are the similarities and what are the differences? I want to introduce a fourth question as well, and that is, what would it have been like to be a woman or a slave in these communities? Well, I think I'll interrupt and let's gather again now in a group. And I hope I've gotten you stirred up enough about these passages that... Well then, let's just talk a little bit about what you came up with, and then I'll do a little bit more talking to explain a little bit about these passages. So, what effect do you think that these passages would have had on these communities? As these communities read them, what effect would they have had on them?
First, the word stable in them.
Mm-hmm. Good. Right, if Paul just died, right, let's say, or Paul has died, or if the community is undergoing some kind of discord or so on, then that would help to stabilize the situation. That's right. What other effect?
Well, I have a question. How much does this picture that you see in Ephesians, well, yes, it keeps the hierarchy in place, but it injects an element in there of respect, love, nurturing, mutual respect from parents and children. Was that a radical message, or was that just articulating something that would be accepted as the good model already in secular society?
In the first century, what was becoming increasingly important was, amongst pagan philosophers in any case, was the ideal of a bond of love between husband and wife. The classical model was that a wife, children, slaves are possessions. Aristotle distinguished between animate and inanimate property, and wives, etc., were animate property. Okay, so there's a kind of, if you will, a humanizing element. That's a little anachronistic. But Ephesians is very much caught up in that more philosophical, secular movement and philosophy at the time. So, do you have an observation from that, then, as to what effect this would have had?
Well, that was what I was wondering then, is injecting that element in there, taking the hierarchy, but also giving a different slant to it and a more radical message, saying, yes, we have this hierarchy, but here's how you should live, and it's different from...
Right.
How others who also have this hierarchy could see it and treat it, or was it indeed the good role model being repeated in the Christian community that they might say having Roman Catholic communities also?
Yeah. I think the short answer to that is that it gets hooked up into Christian theology, but that the ethos is very similar. Okay, other effects? Yes?
If I understood what you said, it was that Paul basically wrote down the mores or the ways that the people were acting as their being. Is this whole true in this case? Is he writing down then, or has it been written that this was the standard for the community in which he had lived?
Well, that's a good question. From what I was arguing yesterday, or from what I was trying to describe yesterday, is that when Paul adopted the household as the model for his mission in the church, and when he baptized households, and then yesterday I was talking about him telling slaves, you know, certainly to buy their freedom if they're able to, but otherwise to remain faithful to their masters and so on. He is, in some sense, then perhaps unintentionally legitimating the kind of social order, so that when Paul writes down, if you will, this code, or when quote unquote Paul writes down this code, perhaps the writer was just describing the reality which the writer had inherited from the previous generation. Okay.
Is that a possibility?
Well, that would be my interpretation. Okay, other effects or questions? on the effects, yes.
Well, question, how does this pattern then of hierarchy differ from what would have been traditional Jewish relationships in families?
Well, again, a hierarchical model, not so established in civic law, where the Greco-Roman household was very much one which was enshrined in law. And the power of the father of the household, who is technically designated as the pater familias, the father of the family, if you will, that the patriarch then has certain rights by law. Traditionally, the right, for example, to execute his wife, although by the first century, that law, the civil magistrate had taken over that function. But in the pre-Christian period, 200 years before Christ, you could have husbands who would have the right to execute their wives.
Well, at least they had the right to child abuse right up through to the 20th century, and nothing was done about it, especially in the 19th century and early 20th century.
Right.
And my opinion is that actually they considered women inferior intellectually until Terman did his intelligence test in the 20s and showed that they were equal. I still think that had an effect on our culture.
When we get to the pastorals, I'll be giving a little bit more of evidence concerning the subjugation of women. And right now, I'm just setting more of a general stage for perhaps a more sinister set of propositions. Yes?
I'm thinking that maybe, like, especially with the Ephesians one you were talking about, there was a lot more feeling with respect and, you know, mutual. It starts out with, what was it, 21? You know, be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. I think if people would read it the right way, it could be a very good thing, you know, encouraging respect and stuff. I think he could have been a little more treating women a little more equally, but you know, whatever. But I think the problem comes when people look at things like, so let wives also be subject in everything to their husband. They pull out a little portion of a whole passage and take it out of context and use it as justification to, you know, for child abuse or whatever they want to do, you know. And I don't think that's what Paul intended at all, but it's so easy for people to find any little thing from the Bible and pull it out and use it for comfort. I think especially in these passages which could be kind of volatile.
Right.
It's easy to do that.
Okay, so not a tyranny, but nonetheless a hierarchy.
Yeah, depending on how you use it. Okay. And it could also be used to for respect and taste.
Other effects?
By giving stability to the current social structure, it would also, though, be it would be encouraging the idea of a hierarchy. And perhaps there's some tension with some things that were said in other parts of the Bible, the more liberating passages and some of the roles maybe that individuals had taken in the early church. This would bring it back again to legitimize the idea that there's an ongoing hierarchy and that you should see things in different levels.
Yeah. There's a hierarchical worldview here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hierarchical cosmology and there's a hierarchical social order. Right. Okay. How do these authors value secular social institutions? Do you think they're good things or bad things, or John?
It maintains the status quo, that's the pyramid.
Right, okay.
And the less freedom there is, I mean, the more stable it will be.
Yeah, right. So high price for stability, perhaps, but certainly. Yeah. So maintain. Oops. Any other ones? Yes, back there.
Well, if you can teach the patriarch to be subject to the Lord, then he is the model and the leader for a whole entire household. So you've reached many people through that one. It's very efficient.
Yes.
From a missionary point of view.
Okay, so efficiency. That's a good one. You're thinking like Paul now. Worse. How does this compare with 1 Corinthians 7:29? 1 Corinthians 7:29 is the passage that I read. Let those who marry live as though they had no wives. Let those who buy live as though they had no goods. And that the present order of this world is passing away.
Well, picking up on that very last point, it doesn't seem as though there's as much of a sense of urgency of the return of the Lord in the Ephesians and Colossians as there is in 1 Corinthians. It seems more of a temporary ethic, so to speak, in 1 Corinthians, because they expect Jesus to come back very, very soon. Whereas the others kind of assume that that's not in the foreground, and it assumes a kind of an ongoing stable household rule that's going to last for a while.
Right, so maybe we could say we're digging in for the long haul?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, what other kinds of differences?
In similarities, I think both of them spoke about serving the Lord. Whatever you do, serve the Lord. And in Corinthians, he said they commended the unmarried men and women. That was uppermost. That's what's beautiful.
Right, so we're back to, we're subject under God.
Yes.
In both instances.
And another similarity is this idea of stability, order, and so forth that comes out in, I think, verse 35. Mm-hmm. I say this not to lay restraint upon you, but to promote good order.
Good.
The other thing that he says is undivided devotion to the Lord.
Right. Okay, so
stability. Which is also implicit in the spousal metaphor about Christ and the church in Ephesians.
Right. Now, that's an interesting point, because he's wanting to ensure that there be devotion to the Lord, right? Mm-hmm. And in a sense, devotion to the Lord in the Corinthians passage is to mitigate the influence of these prevailing social institutions, whereas devotion to the Lord in Colossians and Ephesians is to live up, you know, live according to your appointed role in society.
Yeah.
Right, so there's an interesting difference. Yes.
I've always heard that 1 Corinthians 7 explained in terms that Paul was saying things were so urgent, we don't have time to worry about courtship and marriage and families. We've got more important things to do. What were the more important things to do in that setting? What were they supposed to be busy with if they weren't home with their wives?
Praying. One thing. But another thing is that it would be a fascinating thing to do a whole series on 1 Corinthians, because there were a lot of people who were fairly well-to-do and were very concerned about maintaining their social status and pursuing their social status. And we can discern that from Paul's letter to the Corinthians. And so my guess would be that they were quite concerned about their household duties, perhaps to the detriment of their allegiance to the life in the community, which for Paul, to be in the community is to be in Christ, to form part of the body of Christ. So that they... Their allegiances are somewhat in question, I think. So
then, would a similarity then be that both are calling the Christian community to be somewhat different than the surrounding culture? Mm-hmm. Is that a similarity between like Ephesians and
1
Corinthians or no?
Maybe it is a completely fair question, because some of you may feel that you don't know enough about the period, but is your feel of this that these communities are to be different from the world? Colossians and Ephesians?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes and no. Okay, we have a no here. Why no?
I think that they were still living in the world. They were thinking that they would not be in this world very long. And Paul says himself in Corinthians, this world as it is passing away. But while it's there, they're in a particular position. And in fact, even while he thinks the time is short, he's saying, stay where you are. We don't have time to worry about moving on, if you're a slave, becoming free, if you're single, becoming married. You know, just stay where you are in the world and put your mind to what's coming. You know, don't go any further. Don't worry about answering all these different questions. You know, whereas
later in those other passages, I think they're very much still in the world, but now it's, we're in the world, we're here to stay, you know, how do we live in these institutions? So to me, in both of those passages, they are still very much part of the communities that they are, that they came from.
Okay. Yeah, and then there was a yes, or a sort of a, more of a transformation.
I thought of more as the way Augustine put it, but that a city of a God within the world. Mm-hmm. That they were set in the world, but separate from the world. Mm-hmm.
Their whole motivation changes.
Okay,
I mean, the service works the same, but the motivation now is different.
Okay, so if you will, there are a set of practices, but the reasons for those practices are different. So there's a different kind of ideology connected, different set of ideas, a different way of legitimating the order. Okay. Yes?
Would you be willing to comment on this Ephesians 6:21? Frequently it's thought that this is very unequal as far as the treatment of the husband and the wife, and as I read it, it's really very equal.
5:21.
Right. I think that in the context of the household, reverencing one another or being subject to one another doesn't mean, now we're equals. Rather, it means that, husbands in their lordly place in the household are to love their wives, which means to lead them in particular ways and act as a beneficent householder, if you will, and not as a tyrant, but still as being above. Okay? And a wife is similarly to love a husband by doing all the things that a traditional Greco-Roman woman is supposed to do. Work in the home, remain quiet and diligent at her household tasks, and so on. So that there is to be a bond of love, if you will, but it still remains a hierarchical one. But that's how I would interpret that, given the culture. Yes?
When Paul takes that in the next verses to compare it to Christ and the church, and mm-hmm. talks about the male, the husband as being giving up his life and dying for a life of family, does that affect that hierarchical structure? And how so, if it does?
Yeah. Well, I think that the hierarchy is remains intact, but I'm going to draw a distinction between hierarchy and tyranny. Okay, so that there's a bond of love then, which is nurtured here. But it still remains one person above another person, I would say. There's another question, I think.
When the writer puts a relationship with Jesus as a head and body, you know that Christ died for the church. I don't think you can put the wife much higher in that relationship. The husband is actually instructed to be able to be willing to give his life to the wife.
Right. Okay, so that there's a sacrificial element of love here. But yet, just from a purely institutional perspective, interpretation apart, it still remains a pyramidal kind of structure. Yes, John?
Why is it that I cannot find much in Paul's letters, or whoever wrote them, about kingdom of God? Why is he going so much from the concrete to the abstract? That Jesus goes the other way around. Jesus comes from the abstract and makes it concrete. Jesus is very much concerned about this world and the coming kingdom. Paul is basically way in the future. He says, okay, you're married, but don't worry about your wife, don't make any children for tomorrow, maybe you.
I mean, I think that Paul has a very powerful expectation of a changing social order.
Even if it would end the next day.
Yes. Yeah. I think, in other words, I believe that Paul is in the business of creating as many communities as possible. If you will, he's a man in a hurry. Wasn't there a politician who was a man in a hurry? An American one? I don't remember that. I'm a Canadian, so I don't know these things. But that he is really trying to, he's working feverishly, if you will, to establish communities. And so he's doing whatever it takes to get them off the ground. And if that means then allowing certain social institutions to exist or just using them for the moment, he's very pragmatic. And that then has profound implications for what happens when the church continues onward. I'm just going to go on to the last one. So what was it like to be a woman or a slave in these communities? Lousy.
Well, really, you didn't know that.
I can tell the problem when you have a hierarchy like that, it automatically has in it the seeds of the tyranny. Because if you're in a situation that has that ideal picture and you have the loving, nurturing paterfamilias and who doesn't threaten the slaves, and the slaves are working diligently and loving their master and so forth, that's fine and good. But when that situation is perverted, and because we're human in this world, inevitably, to some extent, it is going to be perverted, there are no alternatives for the women in that picture. There are no alternatives for the children or for the slaves. When you have that kind of hierarchy, it is absolute. And so there's no place to go to get out from under it when it doesn't work.
Yeah, interesting. And picking up on that point, I think, we see a more sinister side of this now when we turn to the pastoral epistles. And that's what I'd like us to do now is again take a look at a few passages from the pastorals. But yes?
What is the Greek word for love here? Husband loved your wives.
I don't think it's the agape root. I'm not sure about that.
To me, that would make some difference in what that means.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I don't have a Greek testament with me. Yeah, if you want.
One more note is that verse 33 says, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband, mm-hmm. which indicates a subservient position.
Certainly.
Yeah. She respects.
If you will, the orientation is from the top down. It's always from the top down. Certainly it's transformed, if you will, by being connected with a emphasis on Christ and Christ's love for the church, but it remains nonetheless from the top down.
Right? Just like the Roman Empire.
Just like the Roman Empire.
Or Constantine.
Right, yes. Yes.
You know, when we talk about respecting our children and who's listening to them and responding to them in ways besides just, you do as I say. Uh-huh. Respect doesn't mean for me, but it means for you.
Yeah. In the ideology of the Roman Empire, though, respect means pretty much obedience. Respect equals obedience more.
But the language for us means something different sometimes.
Yeah. It
doesn't necessarily mean
love. Oh, yeah, it is agape. Yeah. So there's a selfless kind of love there. Which is being enjoined here in Ephesians 5:25.
Maybe that's the only kind of love Paul meant. Agape love.
Uh-huh. Well, that is the preeminent model of love, of course. When Christians come to think about love.
Well, he did know about the prostitutes in Corinth.
Yes. right.
In fact, one of the interesting things about that John brings out is that there's a connection between his openness to these women in Corinth. They get the message of Jesus, the crucified one and the risen one, better than the philosophers in Athens. And that strikes me as close to Luke's idea of the role of women in the Gospel of Luke, the third Gospel. But that's almost one of the only reflections of that you get in Paul. He doesn't accept, without criticism, the traffic in human prostitution that Corinth was famous for. Yeah. But on the other hand, he doesn't condemn these women. He's and yet when he talks about the household rules, the Christian mother, the Christian wife, is put in a situation of almost equality to the slave, of subjugation to the master. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of spiritualizing of his thought that's going on, that he thinks that there, each household needs some kind of a authoritarian Christ figure that is to be rendered in a gendered way, that the male is to take on that role and the woman is not to be thought of as the Christ figure, but as the church figure,
yeah,
and almost in a kind of a Jungian male-female sort of way, or what?
I think if you look at the word subject,
yeah,
the role of the king to the subject means the king takes care of and has compassion for his subject. And the man here has to have compassion and taking care of his wife. That's where the agape idea comes in.
I can relate to that, John, as a man. I guess the problem arises that women have a difficulty in relating to the idea of being subject to, that that's a dominion, an authoritarian role that is, of course, qualified, but what Harry just told us, that the verb there is selfless love and taken care of, but still, you know, we would need women to almost speak about this point.
Yeah, Paul couldn't sell it today.
Paul couldn't sell it today.
Yeah. He couldn't sell it today.
I think he had a hard time selling it then, too. I just want us to sweep. We have about 10 minutes, and I want us to swing into the pastoral. So okay. Keep this on.
What was happening with the church as an organization at this time? Or was it still basically simply households meeting and others coming in from outside to the household? Or
that's
was
how
there
I think
a hierarchy
developed? That's precisely the point now that when we get into the pastoral epistles, we see not only a household code, these passages are called household codes, or the German word is Haustafel, household rules, household tables of duties, and they are basically forms of rhetoric drawn from pagan philosophy, which these writers simply take on and then introduce Christian theology to them. But when we get to the pastoral epistles, to 1 Timothy and Titus and 2 Timothy, we see that not only are there duties enjoined for husbands and wives, but also that the bishops of the community, that is to say the leaders, the elders of the community, these are to be prosperous householders who govern their households well. So what we're seeing then in 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus is we're seeing a more formal kind of church structure developing out of a household hierarchy. And I don't think that was an accident. It seems that there were a lot of women in the communities which 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus are addressed to, which were saying fooey to all this. It seems that they were coming under the influence of teachers who were coming into the community, who for one reason or another were saying to them, abstain from marriage, abstain from sexual relations, enter into the sort of life of asceticism, and that women were really upsetting the communities. So the response then of the writer of 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus is then to kind of just sort of entrench further by using the household code now as a kind of a church order. Right? Paul says that churches are to be governed by prosperous householders. So let the person who governs this household well be a bishop. Right? So we have now really the not only the development of hierarchy, but we have some other things as well going on. So women then are invited to basically do two things. One of them is described in, let's see here, what's my chapter? Let's take a look at 1 Timothy 5, verses 11 to 16. 1 Timothy 5, 11 to 16. Now, 1 Timothy 5, 11 to 16 takes place in the context of the writer trying to create a set of rules over a group of women called widows. And it seems that the widows formed a fairly formal kind of grouping in this community. And the problem is that some women are young widows, and they then seem to be preaching some kind of sexual abstinence to other women. And so Paul then is saying that if you're a young widow, you ought to get married. Okay? And then this is what he, this is how he describes what they're to be doing. So he says in chapter 5, verses 14 and following, "So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, rule their households, and give the enemy no occasion to revile us." Here, probably, we're talking about pagan outsiders who would see a community being unsettled and then thinking that Christianity is bringing some kind of social discord. Okay, so giving the enemy no occasion to revile us. "For some," i.e. some widows, "have already strayed after Satan. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her assist them. Let the church not be burdened, so that it may assist those who are real widows," i.e. a woman over 60 years of age is a real widow. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the young, chaste widow was an ethical ideal in the Roman Empire. So here we have a writer who is saying, no more young, chaste widows, rather young widows just get married again. Okay? Because it seems that these teachers who are coming into the community are having their most success with many of these widows. And again, we don't have time to go through all of the evidence here, but if you take a look at the full context of chapter 5, and also in chapter 3 of 1 Timothy, there is more references there to teachers on unsettled women.
Question?
Yes.
Is there a change of direction here in verse 14, where it says younger widows marry, bear children, rule their households? What does he mean there?
Right. Basically, the man is out in the world doing his thing, and the woman is sort of the domestic. The Roman ideal was that a woman really wasn't even, a high-class woman, if you will, wasn't even seen in public. Rather, she would get her slaves. So she was basically in domestic seclusion.
So defining the word household then means not including the husband, but everything that goes on.
Right, everything that goes on.
Feeding vegetables or something like that.
Right, that's right. So the chief strategy we have then of this writer in neutralizing the threat of women who are upsetting households is to create a church order which places males firmly in control of the church. And we find that, for example, in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 to 13, and in Titus 1, verses 5 to 9. And both of those passages, I don't have time to read them now, but both of them outline the criteria for having the right leader in the community. So the kind of person then who is in control of the community is the prosperous householder. Now let's take a look at another passage. Let's take a look at 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 to 15. And here we have some more references to controlling women. So the writer says, "I desire that in every place the men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Also that women should adorn themselves modestly and sensibly in seemly apparel, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly attire, but by good deeds as befits women who profess religion. Let a woman learn in silence with all submissiveness. I permit no woman to teach or to have authority over men. She is to keep silent. For Adam was formed first and then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet woman will be saved through bearing children if she continues in faith and love and holiness with modesty." Now,
that's only one story of creation. The other one created them equally.
Right. Right. So
why do we always hear that one?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, so women shall be saved through bearing children. Now, remember here that this makes some sense if we have women who are being unsettled by teachers who are coming into the community, inviting them to engage in sexual abstinence. So that really the writer then is sort of giving the reverse picture here. No, women, your duty is to reproduce children faithfully. That is your appointed task in the community and in the order of things.
So why is the church fearing unmarried women? What really is at the root of that?
Well, I think what really is at the root of it is that there is a calling into question of the whole social order. I mean, one of the ways, I mean, there's an author, and you can get his book in the bookstore, and it's by Dennis MacDonald, called The Legend and the Apostle. The subtitle is The Battle for Paul in Canon and Fiction. Okay, and MacDonald argues, and here he's citing some non-New Testament evidence, which is roughly contemporary, of stories of women who get hooked up with apostles and leave their husbands or refuse to engage in sexual relations with their husbands as a sign of devotion to God, a sign of devotion to the apostle, and a sign that this present order is fading away and a new social order is about to dawn. Okay, so now we then are refusing to engage in sexual relations as a sign of our allegiance to a transcendent set of ideals. Okay, so that these prevailing societal institutions and norms no longer hold sway. And the way I show that is I just don't have anything to do with my husband anymore.
So the men are upset.
Right, and I stir up other women to do the same thing. And so there is this description then. Right. There's this description then about in 1 Timothy about women who are not to go about busybodying from household to household.
On behalf of the bookstore, thank you for the commercial.
Right. Is that what he's referring to in 1 Timothy 5:11-12? He says, refuse to enroll younger widows, for when they grow wanton against Christ, that's a sexual word,
yes,
in our culture, right? They desire to marry, and so they incur condemnation for having violated their first pledge. And I was wondering what their first pledge is. Is it celibacy?
Yes.
Oh.
Right. See, I just wonder how much of this is more linked to the notion, which still exists, I think, today, that women are the ones who serve as the temptress.
Mm-hmm.
And they
lead
the male head of household into sin. Mm-hmm. And that's way back related to, you know, interpretations of Eve, that she's,
yes,
really the one who caused the fall.
Right.
And so that you've got this line of thinking where women are not only asked to dress modestly, but also to keep silent so that they won't,
right,
lead the men, the prominent persons in the household who are in the stead of Christ,
right,
to into sin.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that to me it's as convincing to think of them as being some powerful force that people were afraid of because they were rebelling against the social order, but more that the powerful force that they were the possibility of leading,
that's a good point. In fact, and there's been some interesting work done by anthropologists who look at Mediterranean society, mm-hmm, ancient Mediterranean society, and argue that that society was based on the stability of the household.
Mm-hmm.
So who controls the household? It's the woman. So you have all kinds of purity restraints and so on placed on the woman. So don't talk. Be careful what you listen to. You know, you're in seclusion. Be careful what you look at. Be careful how you dress,
mm-hmm,
that all these things then are designed to maintain the stability of the house.